Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the V2 Academy. I'm Chris Lapp and enjoying, as always, got Peter Prickett. How are you doing, Peter?
Thank you.
Yeah, so shortly we'll be joined by Sol Eichson-Hurst, who is a football coach with 10 years' experience of working in Premier League academies with the likes of Tottenham and Chelsea. Before that, we thought we'd quickly discuss the recruitment of players at grassroots level. So, have you got any advice you could give to coaches on like best practice of recruitment?
Best practice, it depends on what you want.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with recruitment at grassroots level is that it can be, it's even looked upon as recruitment in the sense of getting the best people.
Yeah.
So, the thing that's, and it crops up every year, May, June, July, August, you see messages on social media, experienced under nines. Clearly a so, contradiction in terms, an oxymoron.
That's what I can say, oxymoron.
Because they just don't exist.
No.
How can you be 8 years old and experienced? What the coach is saying they want is a player who's played and knows what they're doing because they want to win games.
Yeah.
And there's where I personally have a problem because I've had this at my club. I've had the discussion that players have been leaving a particular team or age group and they're worried about the players that they have got coming in. And my response is, unless you've got a full squad, if someone wants to join, they join. It doesn't matter how good they are.
Yeah.
Because it's a community club. How many grassroots clubs are elite? None, because they're grassroots. It's the nature of the beast. And it's for the community. It's an opportunity for children to play football. It's not an opportunity for people to go and win trophies and be the best in their age group. Because I can guarantee you that there's a team out there who's going to be better than them.
Yeah.
Give them a chance to play. And your worst player under 8 could very easily be your best player under 9. They just got to have the chance to play. So actively recruiting the best players at grassroots level, it's just a dangerous and elitist attempt. In an area that isn't suited to it.
So what's the best ways of going about recruiting then? Should we go to open trials or do you go?
I'm not keen on trials because having trials is straight away you're saying it's in the name, it's a trial. Are you good enough? Good enough for what?
Do you need to have a basic level of playability or? It depends what age we're going at for, really.
Well, again, I wouldn't say it matters. Whatever age. If someone wants to play, they want to play.
Yeah.
And I think this is where some coaches make a mistake. And what they do is, because they've got good players, they think they're a good coach. But actually, you're a good coach if you've taken someone who's not a very good player or wasn't a very good player, and they become a good player.
Yeah.
So your job as a grassroots coach is to improve your players, however good they were to begin with. And actually, it's easier to improve players who aren't very good than to improve players who are good, because the gaps or the strides become harder to take the better they are.
Yeah.
So you want to prove you're a good coach. You're not going to prove it with trophies. You're going to prove it by improving the players that you've got, whoever walks through that door. And also by accepting the challenge and going, yeah, I can see what I can do with that guy. My aim is for him to be the best player by the end of next season.
So So we're delighted to be joined on the line by Saul Eisenhurst. How are you doing this evening, Saul?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so if we do a mini recap of our last interview in case people haven't listened to it. So how did you get into the game? Did you start as a player?
No, I didn't really start. I didn't have an illustrious playing career, but I played a bit, and then I was captain of a university team, and then a friend of mine went out to America to coach out there, and sort of sounded like a good idea.
Yeah.
Went out there for the intention was going to just do a summer, but ended up staying out there for 2 years because I really loved it. Came back and then got a job within the Tottenham Hotspur, the community scheme, which it was then, now it's called the Foundation. Worked my way up into the academy, and then started PDA football, my coaching business in between that, and then got a job at Chelsea and sort of, you know, gone on from there really.
Cool. So, well, yeah, as you mentioned, you've either observed or worked in academies all over the world. So what are the main differences between Europe, the European style, and the American style of academies?
In America, I was working in like grassroots programs and high school programs and stuff like that. But I saw a lot of good young players.
Yeah.
But America's an interesting place because it really is sort of, you know, a lot of mishmash of many different coaching styles. There's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of obviously footballing cultures there. So I was fortunate enough, and I worked for a company which had sort of a similar, so had very like a Dutch style sort of coaching philosophy, which I learned really from scratch.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was very much based around ball mastery and individual technique. But, you know, there's lots of people doing things over there as well. So, you know, it's a massive sport over there, and lots of people doing things. I don't really know a lot about the academy system out there at the moment, though.
That's it. What would you say that the English academies do better than other countries?
What do they do better?
Yeah.
I don't know, really. Depends on which countries you're talking about, really. It's just, you know, when I came in to academy football, I did and still do things, I think, well, people say very differently because I have a different approach to, you know, it's very unconventional. It's not English football at all because basically I learned much of my coaching out there, and my philosophy was based around, you know, different things. And, you know, I did my FA badges, which are very good and interesting, but it's not the way I coached. And, you know, that's so I learned to coach a different way. So, you know, I'm not a very typical English coach, or, you know, archetypal English coach, as it were.
How would you describe your coaching philosophy then?
How would I describe it? I describe it as, you know, technically based. You know, it's always about the ball, the player and the ball. My philosophy has always revolved around good ball-to-player ratios, getting players on the ball as much as possible, letting them go out and express themselves, supporting them in expressing themselves, making them, you know, masters of the ball. You know, technique is key for me. You know, developing technical footballers who can get on the ball and stay on the ball, make things happen and be creative. They're the footballers that always excited me when I was younger. You know, watching, you know, Paul Merson and Bergkamp and Gazza and Model, those players who could do, Peter Beardsley is my favourite player, players who can do, get on the ball and, you know, do something exciting.
So who or what has influenced your coaching style the most? Was it just seeing these players, or was it observing other coaches' work?
It was common, well, really, I mean, I was always like a playground player myself, I think. Well, I was, I grew up in inner London, and, you know, that's very much that sort of similar player as well, like a bit of a dribbler and get on the ball and stuff like that. So, and I was technically always good. I couldn't run, so I had to be technically very good. So then when I went out to America, obviously, I was taught to coach this way. I just thought that was a way of coaching. So I was quite fortunate, really. And so then when I came back to England, I got a job. You know, I was very much like a skills coach, a technical coach. I got a job at Tottenham because the way I was coaching, and at the time, that was when, like I said before, previously, you know, they had, Yul was there, and there was a skills coach there. So, you know, that was they were doing a really, you know, another unique English way of doing things in academy football. No one was doing things like they were doing at the time. So that benefited me. So, and then when I was in there, working with coaches like Chris Ramsey and Danny Buck and, you know, Ricardo, these are amazing, amazing coaches. I learnt loads. And then fortunate enough to work with other coaches and go abroad, you know, visit clubs like Ajax and those sorts of things and see, you know, other technical coaches. That they've helped form my methodology.
I was lucky enough to see Ricardo Moniz working in Hungary. He was at Fenerbahce. Not Fenerbahce, yeah. Ferenc Varos. And I'd always been wanting to see his style because he's not a Curva coach as in the Curva company. He actually worked with Ville Curva himself.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like the misunderstanding, isn't it? Because, like you say, he's a direct disciple, Ville Curva, and it's different, you know, from Curva coaching the coaching brand, you know, here in England. So it's very, you know, important and interesting, differentiation to make. But he's amazing. He's one of the best I've ever seen.
What would you say the difference is, actually? Because there's a perception of Curva from people. Some people just see it as people standing in a line performing tricks around some cones. But if you see the full session structure, that's just one element out of six. How does that compare to Moniz's style?
You know what? I mean, I can't really comment too much on Curva because I don't really know a lot about it. I know Alf Gullestein quite well, and I've seen what his work he does is very good, but it's very different to what Ricardo used to do. Ricardo's sessions much more skill based, high intensity, lots of rotation. Just big key thing about that is lots of rotation, and it's based around the small sided games. So I don't comment too much about what I don't know too much about. You know.
Fair enough. You, like myself, are a keen user of social media.
Yeah.
And this, most people who use social media will know this often leads into debates. And the biggest debate at the moment seems to be almost a civil war going on between those who believe that isolated practice has a place and those who say no. It all has to be match-based.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on this debate?
Well, I believe there's a place for unopposed work. I believe most, you know, if you're in a team session, yeah, most of your stuff should be opposed. And I completely agree with the idea and the rationale behind it because you get multiple outcomes, a lot more decision-making, you need the chaos. But to suggest that to get to an elite level, I'm talking about becoming an elite player here, can get to elite level without doing unopposed technical work, I just think it's ridiculous. And it's really frustrating as well for me, obviously, seeing the players that have come out of the programs, you know, seeing English players, we're talking about English players who have come out of skill-based programs now, you know, regarded as some of the best in Europe, young players, and trying to say, you know, then people are saying from the FA, no, that doesn't work. And that's the most worrying thing, because I just think it's an information gap, it's a misunderstanding, and these people, you know, without actually looking at the evidence which is actually in this country already, that's the most frustrating thing, and let alone the evidence that comes from abroad with, you know, some of the most successful academies, prolific academies in the world using this sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a play, there should be both, and I think that's a problem, is people are in an either or camp. People get this idea that it's either all in this one, it's all in that one, when the reality is obviously, you know, you've got to take bits and pieces and, you know, mould your program.
I think this is the biggest misunderstanding, that those people who are standing against the isolated practices seem to be thinking that those who support isolated practice are saying just do isolated practice. But actually what's being said is if you've got the time to do isolated practices, then it can be beneficial. But if you haven't got the time and you've got a big group, yes, of course, play games.
Yeah, I mean, it's common sense. And the problem is that really, it's the people here are just trying to promote and push their own objective. That's the reality. And, you know, people, I get trolled so much as well. People saying, oh, you just are trying to promote your business. And by people who have, you know, pictures of their book on their profile, or pictures, you know, people, you know, or people, you know, parent, you know, recruitment specialists who, you know, are just trying to promote their own agenda. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's worrying because, you know, I just worry about the future of the young players in this country if we're going down that wrong sort of road.
So when would you, in your programme, use isolated practice?
Pardon, would I?
When would you use the isolated practices?
When would I? It depends. So if I'm team coaching, isolated practice maybe being in the beginning of the sessions, ball mastery, warm up, 1v1. I'm a big proponent of teaching 1v1 skills, not only for developing creativity, but developing explosive movement patterns as well. So developing players' movements on both sides. And then obviously, look, it's, you know, looking at players if people have a proper technical issue. So, you know, work. For instance, a player who's just been released from a Category 1 academy recently, under 16s, because he can't strike the ball. They say he's too small and he can't strike the ball properly. So he's got a technical deficiency. So if that technical deficiency would have been identified earlier, and it was identified earlier, he should have done more isolated shots and had to improve his physical ability to shoot the ball better on both feet. And that's the sort of thing. You say, oh, look, I'm having problems. I can't pass the ball properly. I can't strike the ball with my weak foot. Then you might need some isolated work on that weak foot.
Now, I personally worked with a boy. He's under 10, and his dad came to me and said that, can we develop his shot power? I'm like, well, he's under 10. I think there's other things to worry about, but we'll give it a go. And actually, just by filming him to having a number of shots, we worked out that he over-rotated with his ball striking, and it was fixed quite easily just through a little bit of video work.
Exactly.
If you're working with a team, have you got time within your team session to stand there and film a player taking shot after shot and correct it?
Well, no, that's one of the issues with, I think, in this country, or most many countries, that with team training, obviously, with PDA football, I'm a one-on-one football coach, so the amount of calls, and I've got clients from, you know, I have at the moment, or have had clients from the majority of academies in the southeast, and the same thing is always said. They say they don't do any individual technical work, they don't do any sort of individual work. It's all team-based, it's all team, you know, teams issues, which are either, you know, defending as a unit or attacking or possession. They don't do any individual technical work, and it really is, a lot of places, not all places, not the places I've worked, it's really left up to the individual to sort it out themselves. So, like, you know, this summer I worked with a pro who's a first-year pro at a Premier League club, and he's come to me and he's just, you know, he's raw. He said, you know, he's an attacking player and he's having problems with his crossing. So the same thing, I looked at his crossing technique and I just suggested, look, I looked at it and said, look, try follow through a little bit more, and that was it. He like done it, and then he improved straight away. And then he's, I think, like, go and work on that, and that's to do. So I had a golf lesson, like, you know, this is last year, and the guy said, look, change your handle like this a little bit, change your way you hold the golf club, and he goes, right, now go and practice that, and that's it. So people, this like myth that somehow you're projecting, or you're telling players how to do things, you know, you're limiting them because you're projecting your own ideas of tenacity. That's another myth. It's ridiculous about people who, you know, I don't know if these guys have ever worked with young players before. It's about seeing when player needs a support or issues. And, you know, lots of players have unconventional technique that works. It's good to say, cool, do that. So, for instance, if a player can't cross the ball, you say, okay, look, this is an issue. And this is a first-year pro who, you know, may might not get another pro. So you say, okay, let's have a look at your technique. Let's see if we can support you in changes. See if there's any bad habits you've picked up. And that's reality. That's what coaching's about. You know, it's like... you know, people think this idea that you're living some sort of utopia where you just leave players alone and then they're going to turn into world-class performers. Well, they might do. Some might. But I tell you what, a lot need help as well. A lot need some support down the line.
Isn't this whole area supposed to be a big portion of the youth modules, which are now becoming part of Level 1 and Level 2, but the youth modules, individual challenges, individual goals? So sitting and working with your players and saying, this is what you need to work on. You need to think about this in today's session. You need to think about this in today's session. Or is that not going far enough for you?
Well, I just did the Level 4. I was lucky enough to just do the Advanced Youth Module. And the technical corner, there was no technical content whatsoever. So the message was literally, just let them go and play and be creative. And I was like, well, that's fair enough. But is that it? Really, is that our... is that the limitations of our national federation's outlook? Just letting them go and play? Do you know, and, for me, that's you know, it's questionable. Are we doing enough there to support players? You know, should we, you know, try and create two-footed players, for example? And why not, if we've got players at such a young age, should we not be encouraging them to try and play and develop their weaker foot? it's a very strange approach in my eyes.
Is this not a problem actually of 15 plus years ago, where we were telling players or sending our players to play games and we were bemoaning their lack of technical ability and not addressing it? Is this not the same issue being repeated? So we've slid down a road where we were looking at technique, and then we've gone, actually, no, the problem is they're not creative enough and they don't play enough under pressure. Actually, we need them to play, not for them to work technically.
I think decision was made to go down this road whatsoever, you know, and then they've just gone for it full hearted, and there's no sort of turning back now. So, and I think, you know, rather than look at footballing cultures which have been successful, when you talk about cultures which, you know, player per heads, they're producing more Champions League players than anyone else, now they must be doing something right, you know. Instead, we've gone down a road which is, you know, and I agree with it, you know, you need to let players play and be creative and do that, but it doesn't mean you can't push players. We're talking about league development here. It doesn't mean you can't push and support and challenge. You know what I mean? It's not just about challenge, okay, look, you know, how you gonna, it's about, you've got to challenge individual technique. You know, if a player can't stay on the ball, and this has always been a problem with English football, look at it, you know, if a player can't get on the ball and stay on it under pressure, that is an issue. So how do you do that? Yeah, you support them, let them play three games, but also, yes, you stress them, you play 1v1s a lot, get them on the ball, so they've got to stay on the ball. And people say, oh, 1v1, that's an issue because there's not enough decision-making in it. But they're missing the point. The whole point is about the psychological benefits you get from it, is because they can't take the easy option, they can't pass the ball, they've got to stay on it, and you've got to get technical. And this is like, just talk about trying to create playground players, this is what, you know, this is what happens in the playgrounds, and that you get on the ball, you stay on the ball. It's about, you know, having the courage to do that and make something happen.
I mentioned at the beginning of actually the last podcast about my personal belief is that dribbling and being comfortable on the ball is a mindset. And you don't get that mindset by passing the ball to other people. You get that mindset by taking your natural instinct as a young player, which is, I want to get at him. And most young players want to do that, and enhancing that and letting them do it. And then as they get older, they can learn to pass. Because if you don't have the mindset of wanting to take people on, you can't develop it later. But you can develop a mindset of passing the ball later.
Well, I mean, I think passing is the easy bit. Staying and beating players, you know, with the ball is the difficult bit. You know, that's why, you know, you've spent too much time focused on doing that. Because, you know, you look at European football, they've made the argument, you've got two players, you can just get it and move it and do those things, you know, rather than how many game changes have you got, you know, and players can get on it and beat a player and make something happen. And look at world football, these are the players that cost so much money. These are the Ballon d'Or players, aren't they? The ones who can get on it and stay on it and make something happen.
I was hiring a coach, or looking to hire some coaches, and I interviewed a coach, and I asked him what his style was, and he said that he believed he could teach any player to receive the ball and pass it, and that's what he would coach, because how many Messis are there in the world? And I said, not enough. But Messi didn't become a Messi because he always passed it. And I think that approach will limit our ability as a nation to create game-changing players.
Well, I think it's sort of caught in a little bit of slippery, you know, slope, or like a bit of a cycle where, you know, players go to team trainings at any level and the coach wants to win the game. So, you know, you could lever, that's, you know, you're playing 7-a-side, 9-a-side, and the coach, you know, it's very easy to coach a game to look pretty and be effective. Whereas reality is, you know, to really let the players develop, you've got to give them freedom to go out there and just do what they do and make loads of mistakes in reality and lose games. But then how many people are prepared to lose games at grassroots level or academy level or anything like that, but, you know, for the benefit of long-term player development? That's the issue. And that's an issue, like, you know, said, there's not enough unstructured play, there's not enough street football. We have more, some of these in our more structured environments, so you've got to let players have more freedom to play and develop. But still, you know, challenging them and, you know, supporting them and trying to help them fulfil their potential.
You talked earlier about a perception of the isolated approach creating players who have prescribed or preset moves, and yeah. that being a bit of a myth, what would you say that the actual isolated dribbling practice does give them?
Gives them time to stay on the ball, gives them, creates movements and feints. You know, if you look at the, I looked at 1v1 coaching in young footballers, and I looked at the top leagues in the world and what skills are used. And if you look at reality, the skills that are repeated majority of times, there's only 6, 7, or 8 of them actual skills, with maybe some of those variations. Lots of other different techniques, but these ones are used all the time and used effectively by players in the top leagues, by pros. So my argument would be, teach young players these skills. So like when you teach them how to shoot, you teach them how to pass, you teach them these skills as well. These are skills that top players are using. I mean, it's not saying, you never say, look, you have to use this. You just open it up. It's like you're saying, look, here's like, you know, the Pandora's box, open up, here's all these books of tricks, try these, go and experiment. And then players show you stuff as well, and then you show the other players, you share it as well. But that's why I think you give it. It's about supporting, that way it supports creativity. I remember having this conversation with Sue Cowley on the FA thing. She's the FA's creativity expert. She said the same thing. She said, it's nonsense to think that, you know, that if you're teaching someone a skill, it's going to limit creativity. It's like being an art teacher and teaching someone how to shade or draw. You know, I'm a qualified primary school teacher. You know, don't, just because I'm seeing someone have a new drawing technique, I'm not limiting their drawing, you know, ability. I'm just opening up the world, showing them something, and then they can go and express themselves and try that out.
Well, on the FA courses, they talk about a toolkit, giving coaches a toolkit that they can draw on. And they do say that doesn't mean you have to coach, for example, the old level 2. That doesn't mean you have to go and coach in this stop, stand, still way, but it's something to put in your toolkit. And that's surely the same thing with 3 different types of step over. You're putting it in the player's toolkit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I mean, the main thing is for me is getting them opportunities to do in 1v1s and do that. And, you know, the ball mastery is about developing comfortability, getting players comfortable on the ball, but developing functional explosive movement patterns as well, which will then make them more explosive when they're older players. You know, you're changing the way players play and players move. That's the thing. It's like, yeah, you can leave up to nature's course, but you can actually, you know, improve a player's movement patterns by working, you know, with the ball mastery and the turns on the weak side. And that's a really important element I think we shouldn't forget.
I don't think any coaches would disagree with the principle of putting different moves into players' toolkits. I think where their argument is they would simply say, why can't you do that in a game scenario?
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, you're probably good to do it in a game scenario. And this is like another thing you constantly hear about, oh, but it's unrealistic. A conversation with someone else on Twitter the other day, and they said, oh, they wouldn't use overload in an attacking situation because it's unrealistic. And I was just like, well, I don't know if they have ever worked with young players before. Why would you not use an overload in an attacking situation? Because you give them more shots on target, you give them more opportunities to score. You know, and the same as that, you know, you could do it in a game, but really, are the players going to learn that skill? Are the players going to be able to do turns, new turn on their weak side in a game? No, they're not. They're not going to be able to do that. And I think that's where the information comes out. These coaches don't really understand skills coaching. They don't really understand technical coaching. They think technical coaching is a level FA level 2. It's not. You know, it's proper skills coaching is about proper ball mastery and 1v1 development. That's a completely different thing. And unfortunately, it's foreign to most coaches in this country.
Well, an important thing is the trade-off, understanding what you're trading off. So although in an overloaded situation you are trading off some realism, what you are getting are more returns and more opportunities for repetition. And
exactly, you're talking about getting more repetition, you're getting more chances to shoot in an opposed environment. So, you know, so what they complained about, but then on the other hand, you know, the same people love, they say, oh, we'll use rondos. I go, well, how realistic is a rondo then? A 4v2 or 5v2? It's like, you know, you're just trying to get to grips with, you know, double standards that seem to come out with those same people's arguments.
Well, there's a very simple thing that you can say is, how realistic is training anyway?
Exactly,
if we're going to talk about realism, the only thing that is real then is actually playing a game, because nothing else is realistic. Even a training game between two halves of your squad is not realistic, because the competitive element isn't there. There's nothing realistic other than a match. So, therefore, no training is realistic. And you just end up chasing your tail if you stay there.
Yeah. Well, I saw another one of these guys who talk about this often. They, and they had this soccer school somewhere in, you know, abroad, and he was playing like a 9v9 with young players. And I thought, yeah, that's realistic the game, but yeah, how beneficial is that to a player? You know, what outcomes are you really getting? And that's the issue. It's like people will, you know, forfeit technical outcomes for apparent game decision making. They don't understand actually, you know, yeah, 2v2 or 3v3 might not be like a real game, but do you really want it like a real game for young players? Because the technical outcomes you're going to get, the physical outcomes you're going to get, are going to be so much better, and that's the trade-off you've got to make.
I think it's all about context, isn't it? Looking at someone's 9v9 session, we need to know what came before that, what's coming after it. And I think the same thing with an isolated practice. What's come before it? What has that individual player done before that that he needs to work on? It's where it all sits in the spectrum. And I find it difficult to say that there is, about almost any style, that there is no place for that in the spectrum, because different players will have different needs.
Well, it's quite interesting, like, because that's what I get, you know, I've also got my online training program, mypersonalfootballcoach.com, and people absolutely hammer me on Twitter for that, because they, or wherever, and they say, oh, but, you know, it's a structured environment, but all I'm doing is, you know, supporting players who want to train by themselves. This is the key. They say, well, they'd be better off playing in a game. I say, yeah, but the point is, they're not playing in a game. This is designed for players who want to train by themselves. And it's like, people, like, you know, just lose all sense of, you know, reality. Of course, you know, any player, ask any player growing up, me, you, everyone, did you spend time by yourself outside with the ball? Yes, you did. You know, and you create your own games as well. This is designed for players to make it, to, you know, challenge players and do it. And I can't see, you know, why people so objectify with it. And also because, you know, it gets, you know, players improve on it, you know, and it gets results, and, you know, players and parents tell me how good it is. And it's more, I think it is because people, you know, are so trying to promote their own agenda that they lose sight of, you know, actually reality a little bit.
The key is it's as well as, not instead of.
Exactly.
You mentioned a little bit earlier again about the environment. So you're obviously in the one-to-one environment. It's very technical and quite intense work. In a academy environment, what are you looking for there?
Still, like, I did a session with this team from Poland the other day. Who came over, and a mixed ability group, and the idea is still the same, still high intensity, lots of technical outcomes. First session, I was the theme was Ronaldo dribbling, so never, you know, my base has always been is get the players on the ball as much as possible. So lots of ball mastery, then lots of passing, receiving too, but with, you know, interference, and then lots of 1v1 challenges, 2v2 challenges, 3v3 challenges. So the intensity is always high. And that's the thing I think is a massive thing for me, is your tempo of your session and the intensity of the session has always got to be high, and you're looking for good quality technical outcomes. And, you know, that's based around, you know, 1v1s and small-sided games for me.
The intensity thing is interesting, because I was having a discussion with another coach and we were talking about the intensity and the tempo needs to be higher. I'm actually was going, no, it doesn't. That's not the problem. It's not the intensity. It's the intent.
Yeah.
So there was a high level of intensity and high tempo, but they were forgetting what the outcome was supposed to be. And it's a high level of intent to try and get the outcome that's, for me, is really important.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, listen, I think if you've got, if you've got one or two sessions with a team in a week, then the intensity's got to be high. If you're like, you know, when I was, you know, if you're luxury having players a lot more, then you can afford to drop the intensity. But then, as long as that, you know, is still challenging, and that's why, because you do any, you know, any unopposed work you do, that's the issue of it. It's like you've got to make it high intensity because it's got to be challenging. So I see like a lot of ball mastery practices, which are just like, yeah, let the players go out, show me your ideas. And I'm thinking, that's missing the point, because you're not challenging the players, you're not really stressing them. And the people say, oh, why are you stressing a player, you know, foundation phase 9 to 11s? And this is the issue. It's like people talk about it being too fluffy out there, and that's what the issue is. Like, it's the whole point. You know, you want to challenge a player. It's got to be fun. It's got to be fun. Players enjoy being challenged in a fun, challenging environment, and you test them. And that's the key. That's the sort of things you've got to try and balance for me.
How do you make the one-to-ones challenging?
How do you do it? Well, by stressing the player technically. Stressing the player technically, that's what you've got to do. Make sure he's out of their comfort zone, his or her comfort zone. That's what you got to do. So you identify what the player can do, and then you got to try and push them and see what they, and work to their limits. And that people, that's the thing. For the last couple of weeks, I've worked with professionals, semi-pros, I've worked with amateurs and beginners, and people say they don't have proof of that. They don't know what they're talking about, because you can ask these players, you can see the players who've made benefits from it. That's the thing. That's the key, is about whatever level they are at, they will improve by spending time on the ball, by getting that individual work and being, challenged.
If you see a player over a course of sessions, then do you set them targets? So this week we've done such and such a practice in X amount of time.
Next, all right. So for instance, tomorrow I'm working I've got three sessions tomorrow, right? So one of my sessions with a player who's at a Category 1 academy. I won't tell you which one, because this academy doesn't do any ball mastery or 1v1 work. So I've got a few players from there anyway. But the parent came to me with a particular issue. He said, wants to improve this player's ability in 1v1. All right. So the sessions are revolved around that. Supporting, trying to make him more dynamic, more explosive, more better in 1v1. Give him a few strategies if he needs it, and try and develop those key movements. We're going to try and enhance his ability in that area, so that's quite specific. Whereas another one of my sessions tomorrow with a young player, like semi-pro player, he's a midfielder, so might be more generic. He's a bit older, so maybe more generic midfielder outcomes. But and that's receiving, playing the ball, both feet, turning, lots of different things. So yeah, it depends. But yeah, I mean, the challenge is challenging the player, making sure you get maximum outcomes from them, and they're improving.
Right, so it's time for Ask the Coach, and this week the question has come in from Andrew Henderson. He's asked him, how do you combat the difference between the rate of physical developments between children and teenagers?
It's a challenge, maturation, as it's called. Mm. I mean, if you're in a team environment, you can always think about playing players down or playing players up. That's the first thing many players teams do, but that's not always the best thing. For me, it's about recognising, where a player is in their maturation journey, and then giving maybe smaller players more of a chance, an opportunity. And obviously an understanding, like biological banding as well, seeing where a player, I work with a lot of young players, and the first question I ask them when I meet them is when their birthday is, to see how far along they are compared to their teammates, to their peers. Because you're talking players in foundation phase football, 9, 10 or 11, players can be born in August or September. That's a big difference. So you've got to try and recognise. And then in terms of the question you asked about the little ones, giving the little ones a bit more time maybe, to progress, you've got to see if they've got the footballing ability, the technical brain, the footballing brain, and giving them more time.
Challenging one for me has been with the teenagers when they hit that growth period, and it affects their coordination. And so a player who was technically good, it gets hit by their coordination going. So for a brief period, it could be a year, it could be a year and a half, sometimes it could be 2 years, their technique seems to have disappeared because their coordination is off, because they're growing. And for me, I just had to stick with it, because I knew that player had good technique. I just had to help him through it. I'm not sure if everyone is that patient or understanding.
Probably not. I'm sure people won't get that much time. But I've seen that happen with 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds. They get growth spurts and they never recover to where they were. And some players do, so it's difficult, And it's, how it's about, I suppose you've got to give them time, but how much time do you give them?
Do you want to plug your social media and your websites before
we
go?
Yeah, so you can get me on My Football Coach on Twitter and Instagram. My online coaching company called MyPersonalFootballCoach.com. So it's an online football coaching course. We're in 20 different countries, so we're helping players develop all around the world and coaches as well. And my personal football coaching company is called PDAFootball.co.uk.
Okay, and all these links will be in the description below this podcast.
Fantastic.
So the way the world is now, we're all brands. Everyone's
brand. I really enjoyed speaking to you today. I'm sure Peter has as well. So I'd love to have you on again in the future. So.
Yeah.
I think it's,
All right, guys. Well, thanks very much.
Okay, cheers. Thank you.
Okay, guys. Take care. Yeah.